Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. In this podcast, we'll talk about recent research that sheds new light on glia, a class of cell found in the nervous system. The original research for the basis of this discussion was published in the April 2008 issue of Nature Neuroscience. A summary of this paper appeared in the Editor's Choice section of Science Signaling on April the 1st. Science Signaling editor Liz Adler joined me on the telephone to talk about it. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Annalisa.
So before we get into the experimental data, can you tell us more about what glia are besides being a part of the nervous system?
Well, perhaps the easiest way to tell you what glia are is by telling you what they aren't. There are two main classes of cells that make up nervous tissue, neurons and glia. Neurons are the cells that we typically think of when we say nerve cells. Glia are the cells that aren't neurons. And although most people tend to think of neurons when they think about the nervous system, there are at least 10 times as many glial cells in the central nervous system as there are neurons. So you can think of neurons as the stars of the nervous system, the headliners, if you will, whereas glia can be viewed as members of the chorus line. And just as a good show might depend on both its stars and its chorus, our nervous system requires both neurons and glia.
How do these two types of cells differ?
Let's start with neurons. Neurons are capable of carrying information very rapidly over long distances. For instance, motor neurons, with cell bodies in the spinal cord, extend processes called axons all the way down to our feet, which makes it possible for us to wiggle our toes. The information makes it to the end of the neuron by means of regenerative electrical signals called nerve impulses, or action potentials, which propagate down the axon. The ability to generate action potentials has been considered one of the defining features that distinguish neurons from glia.
But what about neurons in the brain?
Inside the brain, neurons carry messages to other neurons. These messages can be either excitatory to the target neuron, or they can be inhibitory. The place at which a chemical messenger is released from one neuron to carry a message to another is called a synapse.
Then what do glia do?
Well, glia do a lot of different things, and in fact, there's several types of glia. For instance, some types of glia make myelin, an insulating sheath that wraps around the axons of some neurons and helps feed the action potential, which means that you can wiggle your toes just about as fast as you can think about doing it. Other glia regulate the neuronal microenvironment, other glia guide neuronal migration during development, and still other glia act as scavengers, removing the debris that's left behind when a cell is injured or dies.
Did this new study look at all these different kinds of glia?
No, in this study, Cara Dotter and colleagues looked at a specific class of glial cell that has a particular molecule called NG2 on their surface. Such NG2-positive glia are known to give rise to oligodendrocytes, which are the glial cells found in the central nervous system that make myelin.
And what did Cara Dotter and colleagues do to study these glial cells?
They made electrical recordings from NG2-positive glia in regions of the brain where there are many myelinated axons. And intriguingly, they found that about half of the glia were capable of generating action potentials. In fact, some of them made trains of action potentials in response to an appropriate stimulus. That challenges the dogma that neurons are the only cells in the brain that can generate action potentials.
What do action potentials do in the glia? Do they help me wiggle my toes?
Well, we don't really know. Although we do know they're not helping you wiggle your toes. The authors speculated that these action potentials might stimulate the glial cells to become oligodendrocytes, the cells that make myelin. It also seems possible that the action potentials might somehow affect the glial cells' ability to interact with nearby neurons, or maybe with other glial cells. But again, we don't really know.
Okay, so there are two kinds of NG2-positive glial cells, ones that generate action potentials and ones that don't. Are there any other differences between them?
Yes. Some NG2-positive glia receive synaptic input from neurons, and the authors found that the ones that received synaptic input were the ones that fired the action potentials. They also found that under conditions meant to mimic what can happen when the blood supply is interrupted, the electrically active glia suffered more damage and death than the electrically inactive cells did. That difference probably had to do with the excitatory synaptic input to the electrically active cells.
Does this have any medical relevance, since some of these glia are more vulnerable to damage than others?
Yes. For instance, damage to cells that give rise to oligodendrocytes when the brain is developing can contribute to cerebral palsy. And understanding which NG2-positive cells can become oligodendrocytes and what stimulates them to differentiate into oligodendrocytes may also get us a little closer to being able to replace oligodendrocytes that are damaged as a result of stroke or spinal cord injury.
Well, it sounds like this is pretty exciting research that challenges traditional ideas of what glial cells do.
It does.
Well, thanks, Liz.
My pleasure.
The article we discussed was by Kerodotter and colleagues and was titled Spiking and Non-Spiking Classes of Oligodendrocyte Precursor Glia in CNS White Matter. That wraps up this Science Signaling podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Signaling and of AAAS, the Science Society. Our producer is Robert Frederick. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.